Welcome to the Ivy Podcast. We're just two aunties sharing our experience through the lens of one Blackfoot woman and one Anishinaabe woman. And we are Indigenous Vision, an educational nonprofit based in Montana and Arizona. We are 100% Indigenous led, and this is our podcast. Check us out at indigenousvision.org to learn more about our work, make a donation, or play back any of our radio shows and this episode.
Hey, this is the Indigenous Vision Podcast, and we are at our milestone at last. This is officially episode 100. Round of applause.
Wow.
Thank you.
Definitely. I know. Pat on the back. It was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and it took a lot of people to get us here. I know it seems like I'm the face, but it's not. I'm not. There's so many amazing people that help all of the programs grow. You're like 120% awesomeness, Melissa, has helped us.
Oh.
Like, look at this, 100 episodes. I could not do a podcast by myself. I don't have the auditory, you know, the technical skills that it takes. You're a professional producer, so.
Well, thank yes. you. It's been a journey. You know, when you were saying that, I was just thinking about my little apartment on 24th Street where we did the first episode at my little table and my tiny kitchen. It was a studio apartment, so everything was like all together.
Yes.
And I remember thinking, okay, this is it. This is our first podcast. That was like, 3 years ago?
Yeah, yeah. So along with being like 100th episode, we're also 8 years old this year, and we're a couple months late on celebrating our birthday because we do field time. We work scientific, EPA supported, environmental stewardship projects. And right now we're working on like this environmental monitoring and CWD monitoring, contaminant monitoring and CWD susceptibility project. But yeah, we do boots on the ground, and then we get it out through this podcast, and summer is usually our busiest season. So we missed our birthday as well. So this is celebrating 8 years on our 100th episode.
Indigenous Vision. I can't believe it's been 8 years. It seems like it's really flown by. I think we started the podcast technically 4 years ago in 2019, maybe even like late 2018. I'd really have to go back and look in the files, but we've talked about so many things, and I wanted to highlight all of the amazing guests we've had on the podcast.
Yes, yes, because these guests cover amazing issues. They're the most knowledgeable people that we've come across in the field, and members of their own community impacted by the issues that they're working on. And so they're like us.
Yeah. Right. We've had Crystal Lightning. We've had Cece Meadows of Prados Beauty. We've had, I remember, Alex Whiteplume.
Yes, he's
that was one
cool
of my
guy.
Favorite yes. ones. We've had Melanie Turvalon for the Cultural Humility series, which, by the way, is a whole other series of podcasts that we've done. Technically not part of the 100, so we're technically over 100 if
oh,
we
yeah.
factor in that.
Yeah, and if you factor in the Ivy music, like, you've been killing it.
Hundreds.
We're like in the 300s. So yeah, we're not noobs. Noobs, Minecraft language from my son.
Heck but no, yes. we're turning into like almost superpower elder status, in my opinion,
in the podcast world. The older aunties, we need some younger aunties in here, because yeah, we're 40 years old, and so we need that 20-year-old perspective. But that's where our guests come in. We get to talk with so many women and girls from across the community. And that's kind of that's a underlying theme because of the nature of our work that we do, our culture humility. So we're always talking about the isms, you know, racism, classism, socioeconomicism, you know, discrimination, all those things. And then we get into, I work on boots on the ground kind of environmental injustice projects, which is usually my lane is the hydrology and watershed lane. So I look at contaminants and quantity and quality. And I do riparian area, like reparations, recovery, and building it back up and planting willows. And so we've just combined like our caring for women and caring for each other and caring for ourselves, which is a big part of cultural humility, is that compassion. And that goes, you know, it's a reciprocal thing. But we've combined that all and we've become this organization that is about women and culture and environment. And then, you know, just peace, really. I really like the New York piece of land. And then the landowner that we got in here in Montana, where she says, you know, this land isn't as beautiful if it doesn't have Blackfoot people on it doing their thing. And our thing is picking the berries, monitoring the herds, hunting, collecting our pines and our willows and all of the roots that we find out on the prairies and plains. And so, yeah, I just love the combination of who we are and what we've become and how many people have helped. Like, so most of the work is done through contractors and volunteers. And so the New York property in Southern New York is going to be a kind of an experimental stewardship. The experimental part of it is that it's us as young Indigenous people implementing methods that are tens of thousands of years old and through stories that we've heard in what we're calling like kind of like the Lubrecht experimental forest here that gives opportunities for University of Montana students to learn forest management and soil and ecosystem work. And so I want to mirror our little 20 acres similarly in a food forest. And so all scientific projects done on the land, all management and all stewardship efforts should create more bountiful abundance and diversity in the land that promotes culture. And so then as women and members of the community, we have hassle-free areas where we can get our herbs and plants and just be ourselves. And so
beautiful how far you've come in the 8 years since it started in Phoenix, Arizona, and our little apartments, all of our big dreams, your big dreams, I watched slowly just kind of hatch themselves into reality. I remember when you wanted to do a talk show in the beginning.
Yes. Yes. And that's what this is kind of. Yeah.
It was kind of like you wanted to get the message out there, but in the format of like a talk show. And I remember upholstering some couches with you and like getting that whole setup ready.
Oh, that was so fun. Yes. Okay.
So fun.
So in the origins of Indigenous Vision started with me and Laura Medina, and she is a student and she works at ASU in Phoenix, Arizona. And we were all over Phoenix and Mesa doing our projects together and individually. And I'm like, man, we're doing this out of our own pocket. And so I really wanted to start something where people like us had a place to, like a 501c3, so that we could get grants to do the work that we were doing, because I really believe in the impact made by community members who pick up, you know, the tools and just start chipping away at making their communities safer, brighter, more beautiful places. And that's me and all of the people and friends I have. My friends are very cool. I have tons of friends. And so these people I know all over the country, in Canada and the US, and they range from grassroots activists, community organizers, teachers, community leaders, community government leaders, municipal leaders, people who are in university and academia, students. That's everybody, isn't it? Like, I feel like, yeah. I know every, like, so these are all the people who have volunteered or have led a project or have been involved, tons and tons of musicians. I think in those first two or three years, Simple Ali 20 was really pivotal in our community organizing, because we drew the community of Phoenix and with music and shows. Whenever we had an important issue, we would kind of do like mix some music in with it. And I think it worked. It drew people out. And because it was after the Idol No More and the flash mobs of 2011. And that's when I think Laura and I had met each other at LA Canadian Embassy, where they were protesting Bill C-45 that was going to take away 90% of the water protections in Canada, except for around Cottage Country in Ottawa, where most of the country's leaders have their mansions. Isn't that funny? But the navigable lakes and all of our freshwater wetlands, all of the protections that they had formerly had been lifted to make way for industry. And so, of course, Indigenous people who live off of the land have a problem with that. And so Canada erupted, the world, you know, the Indigenous world and environmental world erupted. And And Laura and I met each other. And that's also where I first met Crystal, Lightning, and Henry. It was there at the Canadian Embassy in LA. And so I met a lot of people there. There was another girl. She goes by Corn Maiden Akale. I also met her. She lives down in Denver, and she does a lot of great work for her community in terms of Indigenous education. So it's just like all those original founding people were kind of right there in LA at the Canadian Embassy, who are kind of still with me in some way or another. Crystal and Henry, years down the road at our 2017 Life Spa Camp, and Life Spa stands for Living Indigenous and Fostering Empowerment. The spa part as the emphasis on self-care and compassion for self, because there was Indigenous history learning in there for the girls, which they primarily came from like youth homes and group homes and foster care homes. And so I collected some aunties and grandmas, and Crystal was one of the aunties and one of the workshop leaders, teaching the girls how to write poetry. And then Henry and Omar helped them put it to a beat. And we have some music videos up that we should highlight on the website now. Many of these girls now are in their early 20s and have children and are doing fairly good. You know, like, you know, they're living the same life we are, Melissa. Like, we're, you know, the struggle, right?
For real.
We have to, you know, make a living from nothing. Yeah, all of those original people really definitely contributed and helped out. And Laura segued off and led Indigenous Peoples Day and did major waves in the Phoenix area community, in establishing IPD there. And the mayor, oh my goodness, that was so, like, during that forming time, like, because I was still working at as a water resource specialist, training water operators in the Phoenix area during this time. And so I still hadn't quit my job yet, and I was still trying to, you know, file all the paperwork and do everything, which I went through a service, which I will not mention because I feel like we're big enough that they could sponsor us now.
Heck yeah.
Right. And so I got all the paperwork done. And then Roddenberry Foundation and the fellowship was the first people who really believed in me. There was actually an Indigenous led Colorado, Northern Arizona organization, maybe they're based in Flagstaff, that I applied for a grant from for funding for the MAP, which kind of like is the basis and foundation of all of our, you know, we map MMIW, we map environmental contaminants, we map abandoned mines, I'm mapping CWD and diseases and wildlife, and then combining them all together to get this big cumulative, big picture view. And what I'm finding and what you see when I actually put all the individual maps that you see on our website together is that where women and Indigenous people are meeting violence, we're also seeing higher contamination levels and more like closer proximity to Superfund sites. And the narrative of environmental injustices and EJ cases being located in and around people of color, and then the demographics that kind of ripple out from there in terms of health and disease are all true, which, you know, so yeah.
Amazing work. Like, it really, really has. I've really watched you bloom into this huge organization now. It feels big to me still from witnessing it grow from this little spot in Phoenix and that old house that you used to live in to like where you are now and the board and all the things that you've done, all the people that you've impacted, all of the projects that are currently ongoing. I remember just being, I just had met you and I was like, oh, I can do a radio show. I mentioned because I was fresh off my commercial radio career and I started slowly contributing the celebration aspect of what you were doing because I wanted to kind of balance the mood, right? Like, we're working on all this heavy environmental stuff and MMIW and all of these rights. And I thought, well, we need something to be happy about and celebrate over. So Ivy Music was born and I slowly put in my contributions to kind of lift the spirits up over time. And here we are, like, I think I'm doing episode 257 later on this week. And it's just been a journey to watch and see you grow and slightly be a part of it over the past few years and then become a bigger part of it since the pandemic started is when I really started to get involved. And when cultural humility was introduced, that's when I was like, whoa, my mind was completely blown in 2019.
Yeah. And that's when, well, that's when disease hit me, was in 2017, 2016, something that I had been monitoring since about 2014 or 15, kind of got worse in those years. Sorry if you hear my urban life in the background. I don't know if
I was going to say,
catches the alarm. Does it?
You're kind of in like a rural, it looks rural to me, but you're still by a main road.
Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah. The ambulances go by all the time. Yeah. So that's where in 2017, I kind of hit this wall of, well, I was pregnant and I had a baby growing inside of me. So I really became cognizant of what was happening to me and the environmental exposures that I was having in terms of stress, music, food, all kinds of things like that. And so during that time, I was working on one of the original MMIP maps. And I started doing the P part because I realized that that's a whole nother episode, but why the P instead of just MMIWG, two spirit. But yeah, I was getting a little haunted. I've always done this job like after my job, after work in the beginning. And so I was sitting in the dark mapping out people who had gone missing and people who were found murdered. And it was really spooky. It started to weigh down on me. And I thought that that wasn't a really sustainable way to continue. And that it couldn't be a program that I could ask anybody else to do because of the emotional toll it was taking on me. And given I'm a little bit more, I feel like I'm tapped into my emotions and I feel them a lot. I did factor that in there, but it's a lot to go through. And I didn't feel like I could ask anyone else to do that. And so I started mapping out like happy environmental stories and happy, like cool stories. And that's where I really started kind of focusing more on the place map and the place names of Blackfoot places. And then places that I came across that are public places along the road in Arizona and New Mexico. You know, Indigenous people have a much different narrative of what, you know, first settler organizations and groups put on signs by our roads in the 1920s and 50s and 60s. A lot of the signs from 70s and 80s are still outdated, like grossly. And I think a lot of those narratives on signs across the country contribute to the mistreatment and the stereotypes of Native people today. And it's because it's because terminology matters. Like if you live in an all primarily white state, but you have a lot of mountains called I really hate saying that word. Like, can you beat me out on the mountain? And then Dead Indian Mountain or like Savage Mountain or Savage Road. Like you have all these roads that create sentiments of who we are as people. And then we have to go out there now as the new generation of kids and receive that treatment. That's one of the unjust narratives I'm working on. And so that's a citizen science project. Anyone can go onto our website and download a form and give us the lat long, the GPS, and then the little description and then the alternative description. We're not out to erase anybody's narrative, but there are many perspectives of one place. I think all of those should be honored. There's not one right way, right? That's culture humility.
It really, really is. And it's amazing that you're working on something like that, because there's been many times, even I was so shocked when I heard people call that mountain that name when I first arrived in Arizona. And I just thought, how is this happening? And how is this normalized? Hear that you guys were working on that, I thought, whew, at least someone's trying to do something about it, because it just was out of hand. It felt
shocking. That was my culture shock moving to the Southwest too, is that moving from Canada and Montana, we have primarily French influence. And so all of our slang and, you know, derogatory words are French, and that is a French originating word. And so we are the brown people who were the recipients of that word, kind of like, you know, you think of all of the well-known derogatory Spanish words. People in the north in Ottawa and Toronto and Vancouver wouldn't the same as somebody in downtown Phoenix would receive them, right? Yeah, our culture shock as Canadians coming to the Southwest, where that word was like freely thrown around, but the mayor put his foot down and actually stood up for me. And I had already quit the job that didn't support me or didn't find the right training for my person who... Well, he said I was yelling at work, and I was like, wow. And it's amazing how people perceive you, because yeah, he had asked me what mountain I went running on, because I came to work all red. And he's like, I was like, Piastowa. And he said, oh, you mean, and I said, no, Piastowa, that's really offensive. That's really derogatory. And so when we engaged in how derogatory and offensive and where I come from in Canada, and how, so he perceived that as yelling from me. And I didn't, you know, I saw some people like friends poke their head over. I thought they were friends. I don't know if they really are, because they didn't stand up for me. And they were brown women as well. And I saw them peek their head over the cubicle, but I didn't hear anyone like back up that I was yelling. And I'm not a yeller either. Like, I'm just not a yeller.
I can confirm that. 100% true.
But yeah, like my voice is really soft and it breaks if I get too loud. And I've gone to voice coaches and vocal coaches for my speaking and presentations. And I want to be a singer, but I just don't have the projection. And so I kind of refrain from like loudness because I'm embarrassed of how my voice breaks. Anyway, they sent him to a sexual harassment training for that after a couple of months, and it wasn't an immediate training. And then they had me talk with a bunch of people and made me feel like it was me having a problem and not that it was his words that were the problem, as we worked at a Native organization and we have to either contribute or halt stereotypes and derogatory perceptions of Native people. That's our role as Indigenous people who filter in and out of what the quote unquote white world, right? Like we, whether we like it or not, we're representation. When people encounter us, they make all assumptions for everybody else behind us. And so, yeah, it matters how we behave and it matters the words we use. And that was the experience where I really decided to dig my heels into my master's training, which is in organizational development and culture change and innovative leadership. And so culture humility was one of the things that were kind of like talked about in there with cultural competency. And I had met a moment in my career where that was humility was a thing that was really, really needed. And I did my part. I stepped back and I looked at like the regional context of how the culture clash happened. And I couldn't explain or take any more energy from myself because it's emotional and it's hard. And those are microaggressions. And microaggressions on repeat make one hell of a life to live through. And it's not a place you want to work. And so culture humility, right?
I remember you wondering, like, was this the right choice to leave and pursue the nonprofit full time ever? I'll never forget, because I did a card reading about it. Remember?
Yes. Oh, yes.
I was divining the energy and I thought, and right away it said, you are going to be just fine. I'll never forget the card either that came up. It was the fire card. And it pretty much said that no matter where you go, your path is going to be illuminated. And I was like, go for it. And you did. And like, here we are 8 years later on the 100th podcast episode. All of these amazing projects are going. We're on the brink of like even more greatness. We're heading out to a special event in September. We've got a cultural humility class coming up. It's just growing bigger and bigger. And I can't wait till we're talking about this on the 10th anniversary when we're gushing about how the past 2 years or the upcoming 2 years has been amazing, or even more amazing.
Right. I know. I can forecast, like, here's my dreaming part of me is we have more states than not like more than half of the states holding self-defense classes in communities or schools. Then we have more schools actually moving in and supporting and following suit with the Indiana high schools, who have been doing self-defense as like a PE course since the 70s. And their girls meet 50% less sexual violence than other girls that don't have self-defense while in high school during their college years. And if we could give any woman 50% less violence in her life, holy cow, let's do
it. I'll take it.
Let's do it. And so that's my effort with the self-defense. And it takes 6 weeks to get that muscle memory. And then you either, I want you to continue your training. We can't afford to pay for anything beyond that because we're just like a $100,000 organization. On that note, our funders have been amazing. The people who originally supported me was not the Native Environmental Group. They said, like, their literal reply to me was, how do maps protect water? And I went, how do maps protect water? And I'm like, we don't even have time to get into that. And I don't even have time to be offended as a watershed scientist who maps watersheds and protects water quality and quantity. That's what all of our grassroots community organizers and activists are missing. They're missing the scientific data from our perspective. A Native scientist tallying up all of our significant places within a watershed and all of the contaminants and industry activity that are near those significant places. How do we know what to protect if we don't know where anything is or what activity is at what amount? And so that's, me and my water resource training. And so they didn't support us. They didn't fund us. And they actually were very insulting. And then I didn't have much time to be too sad about it because almost the next day, very quick turnaround time, the Roddenberry Fellowship selected me and my application. And I remember I was nursing Onan at that time through most of the application. I was selected of one of 20 out of more than 3,000 applications. And it was the same map project that I had submitted to the Native organization. And they called it phenomenal and groundbreaking and beautiful. And they brought me in and they gave me coaches and they gave me presentation training and they gave me money without a tag on it. And they said, you know your community best. You put it where you think it needs to go. I built up IV. I built up the maps to a place where I could sell them a little better, like how I want to protect and how we need to protect this on a competitive scientific level with the Western world. Roddenberry was so cool. They took me across the world, Brooklyn, LA, and they're meeting in Denver. I can't go again this year, but my love is with all of them because they're such an amazing group of people. They're just the dreamers, the doers, and the get this doneers. And we're going to smile while we're doing it. And so I love the energy of all the people that Roddenberry family. Thank you, Gene Roddenberry, for, envisioning Star Trek. And Star Trek is really cool because they had the first interspecies kiss on television in like the 60s, and it caused a big stir and chaos in the world. And so I love that spirit and that sentiment. Change happens and we can either fear it or we can be excited about it. And that's one of the brain psychologists speaking that they also provided me free coaching with. So Roddenberry Foundation is absolutely amazing for getting us here and keeping me going at a mental and spiritual, energetic level for doing this kind of work because it's so exhausting. And then Novo Foundation came in and Tides Foundation came in. And between the two of them, they have put us back and forth between the two and supported us with $100,000 a year of general operating funds. And so then we've been responsible for making up anywhere between 40 and 60. This year we did really good. I think it was 80. We reached over into the 225,000 with the project budget grants. And so those are not general operating funds. They're just project specific with no general operating funds in them. So We really love those general operating supporters, Tides, Novo, and the Rockefeller Foundation more recently and currently as our funder.
Another great partnership that we've developed over the past couple of years is with Grantmakers for Girls of Color. I know our youth coordinator, Faye, was a part of the Hawaii trip and a couple of other events that happened last year, going to New York and creating a grant for girls. And just following them on social media is so inspiring because they truly do so much. So we should probably give a big shout out to Raina as well for reaching out to us and like putting together all the awesome events like Hawaii. That was so amazing. So Grantmakers for Girls of Color, thank you so much for contributing, especially to our MMIW efforts.
They were so, well, they funded this event here and mostly the self-defense kits that went across four or five different states. And so those were, everybody really loved those. And I saw that, those keychains were actually used and sent out by a, I don't know if the shelter was giving them out, but I saw someone in Phoenix post a keychain that looked like ours. And I was like, I wonder if that's ours because it was a pink pepper spray. And I didn't, yeah. But I wonder, I don't think that shelters often give out self-defense kits like that. So, yeah, I think one of those made it down into a shelter in Phoenix. They're just amazing people. And I would like to find, I feel like they're really far away and they're just like these magical angels who read my papers and are like, yes, you're funded. And I would love to meet them in person because I don't know if they know how big of a difference that they're making in my life and in your life. Like they're like for just two Native women, they're, I mean, we're still teetering on like poverty style life, but we're getting out of it.
Yeah, my life has improved greatly because of the work that you've been doing, like greatly.
Yeah, it's just I just get emotional if I like really start thinking about all of the support we've had and all of the real impact it's had because we send out those emergency, we don't talk about it very much. I don't like to hand out food and take a selfie and then be like, see, we're doing something. I think that's really cruel. Over the years, we've been, I guess I should have tallied up the number for this episode, but we spend thousands over the years in sending out $150 at a time in health honorariums and emergency honorariums for people who are in need. And those are just kind of just crazy circumstances that we find ourselves in as Native people who don't have access to credit or resources or, the rich aunt or uncle or the
Right,
crazy
like
things that this world makes us like
rich
normal.
grandparents, like that's a big a thing that I witnessed a lot of my non-Indigenous friends get help from was like, oh, my grandparents got me, or the generational wealth, like that's something that we do not have. So when you're sending out the mutual aid, like you're helping people in real time going through it. Like the it that we're talking about is the colonial state of people going through their issues, whether it be like trying to get across the country on, one vehicle, like how are you going to get to your territory, or if your house burns down, something like that. Like it's been a lot of amazing help from Indigenous Vision.
And it's not much. It's like $100, $150. And
Goes a long way,
it
though.
goes a long way. It pays the cell phone bill for the whole month. And that sometimes determines if you can get the job or not. And so, yeah.
Exactly.
Those little chunks of change make a big difference. Yeah, those are the things that I needed when I was going to school and I was fortunate enough to have funding and help from my tribe. They were able to pay my rent while I went to get my master's degree.
Nice.
And so, yeah, I was responsible for my car payment and feeding myself and getting to school. And so, yeah, I did it and I got straight A's. I'm really appreciative. Yeah. You can't make anybody. Nobody is made by themselves. I don't think anybody brings them from the ground up to where they're at. I had tons of help, my mom and family, friends, you. Oh my goodness. So
It's a lot.
I'm just thankful for everybody's contributions. And even the bad experiences. There was when I was trying to develop the map app has been the most struggle that we've
I've
had as
noticed
a
since the
program.
beginning. I've heard it in many different phases and many different ways of it changing.
Yeah, and right now we're informally partnered with audio.com, and they would like us to submit some of their stories on there. But yeah, we're struggling with general capacity right now and keeping my people and my mappers, my elders going. And this summer was really hard, like health-wise, and for those the mapping group that we have. So a couple of emergency, like even within our team, emergency honorariums go out. And so, but yeah, that we lost $7,000 on a bad deal with my original app developer. And that had to be probably my most disappointing, like disappointed in myself, disappointed in my resources, because I don't have a lawyer to look over these contracts. I don't have a lawyer to sit in with me when I'm negotiating terms. And so we had talked for a year or longer than that, described the whole project. They were enthusiastic. And then they let me know, they're like, okay, well, at first they were like, this will take 10 phases and $100,000. And then it dropped down to like, well, 6 or 7 phases. And I'm like, okay, if I keep going over the years, and I could pay that off in chunks, you know? And so I engaged in business with them. After talking with them for a year, I felt like they had known the project, and they developed the app, and I paid them. And after like digging into the app, like it was just my map on the cell phone. It was the same map on the cell phone. And I'm like, this is, and they're like, this is just phase one. And I'm like, no, this is not enough phase for the $8,000, $7,995 is what they had us pay them. And it was basically as if I just put my Esri app function on. I couldn't see, like, then I saw them, like, I don't know what they call that, like penny pinching, but they didn't give as much as they said they would give. And there was not enough of the app that I couldn't do by myself for $8,000. And then they said there was 6 more phases after that. And so I disengaged with them, ended. There's no more further phases, no more phases on this contract. It's over. This is as far as we'll go. I didn't get what I expected.
Wow.
And
I remember that loss.
I'm still a little hard on myself for it, because it's not an easy amount of money to let go. And it's a really hard lesson to learn about how you think you could be communicating with somebody on weekly, bi-weekly meetings and still miss the mark somehow. And I would love to get to the point where we do have a lawyer on contract, or and I could just send them our paperwork and they can look it over and say, this is a good one. No, you're not going to get taken. There's no misunderstanding from what your needs are to what they're giving you. I would love that.
I would love to be lawyered up too. There's so many like clients that we could potentially work with who could definitely see our side more clearly. And so we don't get taken advantage of, because that's been the historical narrative, is like native organizations moving around in this weird system. And then these big, long time standing organizations or other companies or whatever they want to call themselves come in and swoop in, and they know better and they've got all the hard data. And we're just this little organization of two native ladies being taken advantage of. So if we were lawyered up, no way.
Right. University of North Dakota did it right. So they did a study on MMIW, and they contacted me, and well, that she tracked me down. She hit my Messenger, my LinkedIn, my Facebook, my email. And I responded through my work email, and she wanted to license the Kicking Ribbon Girl image that we use for our self-defense class. And I was so appreciative of her saying, where'd you get the image? Who made it? And I'm like, I made it. I put it together. I assembled it in Canva. I know. I've been teased by that, sadly, about by other activists. Who cares how you make your flyer? Get the flyer out there.
Exactly.
So I am a little shy when I say, I do my stuff on Canva, but we pay for it. It's a subscription, and they've been good to us. And so they licensed Kicking Ribbon Girl for $250, and that goes back into paying. Like, we have since paid probably 5 or 6 instructors since they sent that check over. So thank you for people and institutions going about it the right way and not exploiting and not appropriating or stealing.
Exactly. Thank you to the people who aren't trash.
And it's funny, like I woke up this morning, I got a really good night's sleep last night because I put Onan to sleep early for school and I accidentally stayed asleep the whole time and then woke up at my regular 6 a.m. time, which is like 10 hours of sleep, which is the longest amount of
Good.
sleep that I've had probably since school got out. So maybe school's a good thing for me. I kind of chuckled to myself because I don't know what I listened to before I went to bed or what I dreamt about, but I woke up this morning and I was so psyched to get up. Like before I even opened my eyes, I thought to myself, I'm gonna do business like a white man today.
Oh, watch
Gonna
out.
do business like a white man today. And so, yeah.
Yeah, when you messaged me about recording today, because I forgot, I'm the one who's like, I'm like a sleepy sloth right now. I was like, and I saw your setup. I was like, woo, Suta is on it today. You're like standing up, you're in your kitchen today. Normally you're at your desk and it's like super chill, but today I can feel the energy.
I'm gonna do business like I'm getting the full dollar today instead of my
Oh.
stinking 57 cents. You know, white women get, I think it's a 72 or 73
Yeah,
cents
it's in the
per
70s.
dollars. Yeah, and then once you get into people of color, we're making like anywhere in the realm of 53 to 57 cents per dollar. So that was my inspiration for I'm gonna do
Beautiful.
business like a white man today.
Getting it done. Episode 100 right here. So we have a lot to look forward to. I know I've been officially like involved heavily now in IV since the pandemic pretty much happened. We'll say early 2021, late 2020. Basically, when I moved to Vegas is when I got really involved, and it's been amazing. And again, thanks to everyone who supported us, anyone who's even liked anything we've posted on Facebook or Instagram who follow us. We recently surpassed the 1,000 follower mark on Instagram, which took forever, but we're like the slow and steady. And that's personally how I like to move through life. I am not in a rush to do anything. I'm about just letting it flow and happen. And if it feels right, I'm going to jump on board. And that's exactly what I did with this organization. And cultural humility played an enormous part on that because it really helped me reflect. And as long as I just keep turning the lens to myself and keep bringing it back to myself, it really does help moving forward. So I am just excited about what's to come and just be a part of this movement of people who want to make, who genuinely are making the moves to make the world better, because this is the only way that I've learned how to do that. I've tried a lot of different strategies over my career in radio, just in personal life, but I found working with the organization and cultural humility is where it's at for me. So if you want to get on this train or this like party bus that we're on, join up or sign up for our next training on October 17th. I'll post all the details like I always do in the show notes for our episode.
Beautiful. I think the overarching theme of our organization and of our work and everything we do is to be the change you want to see.
Thank you so much for listening to the Indigenous Vision Podcast, or the IV Podcast, as we like to call it. Our official milestone 100th episode. We truly appreciate you for being here. Your support means so much to us. You can find out more about what we do and what we represent on our website, indigenousvision.org. Follow us on Facebook at Indigenous Vision and on Instagram, Indigenous Vision Media. If you are feeling compelled to support us financially, you can always make a donation on our website. It's right on our homepage at indigenousvision.org. And don't forget, we do have a cultural humility training coming up this October 17th, where we get together virtually for 10 hours over 4 days for 2.5 hours per day. We would love to have you join us. All are welcome to attend. Registration is officially open once again, indigenousvision.org/cultural humility. Thank you for listening to the 100th episode. We will be back sooner than later.